This is 1A. Happy Friday. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announces that House Democrats will begin drafting articles of impeachment against President Trump. Attorney General Bill Barr weighs in on protests against police. And Democratic candidate Senator Kamala Harris drops out of the presidential race. Just some of the stories we'll be discussing today on the Friday News Roundup. And here with us to discuss this week's top headlines are three of my favorite people, starting with Ed O'Keefe, a political correspondent with CBS News. Ed, welcome back.
Great to see you.
Cheryl Gay Stolberg, a congressional correspondent with the New York Times. Hi, Cheryl.
Hey, Joshua.
And Jeff Mason, a White House correspondent with Reuters. Jeff, welcome.
Great to be with you, Joshua.
We would love to hear from you. My absolute favorite person is you, of course, because you send in questions and thoughts about this week's news. So keep it up. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. So let's start with impeachment and that announcement yesterday from House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. She announced that the Democrats are moving ahead with drafting articles of impeachment against President Trump, and the announcement was nothing if not somber.
Our democracy is what is at stake. The president leaves us no choice but to act because he is trying to corrupt once again the election for his own benefit. The president has engaged in abuse of power, undermining our national security and jeopardizing the integrity of our elections. His actions are in defiance of the vision of our founders and the oath of office that he takes to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. Sadly, but with confidence and humility, with allegiance to our founders, and a heart full of love for America. Today, I am asking our chairman to proceed with articles of impeachment.
That was House Speaker Nancy Pelosi making the announcement yesterday morning. Now, Ed O'Keefe, I don't think the announcement catches anyone by surprise. We pretty much knew this was going to happen, but what more do we know in terms of what might be in those articles of impeachment? I don't think that's quite been spelled out yet.
We haven't, and I suspect people like Cheryl are going to figure out over the weekend what exactly they're debating, because we expect the Judiciary Committee to spend the weekend mulling their options. But essentially, we're looking at articles that would have to do with obstruction of justice, bribery, and then possibly things like abuse of power or obstruction of Congress. And it's that bribery one that has really, I think, stoked a lot of interest and speculation over the last few weeks, because it's like, well, hold on a second. What kind of bribery are we talking about? And I think one of the things to remember throughout this whole debate, and we saw some of it in the discourse between the law professors this week, the crash course in constitutional law we all got whether we liked it or not, was they're not talking about sort of the standard legal definition of bribery, but the constitutional one, because bribery is one of only two potential crimes that is specifically outlined in Article 2, Section 4, treason being the other one. And what they're looking at specifically is this sort of the idea that when you take private benefits or ask for private benefits and get them in return for an official act, and that is what they're accusing the president of having done, telling the Ukrainian leader, if you look into the Bidens, you will get your visit and I will release the military. At least that's what they accuse him of.
And that's one of the big points that's been made this week, is that what the founders intended in terms of impeachment had to do with a constitutional violation rather than like a statutory violation of a specific crime that's on the books. But Cheryl, with regard to what Ed said, what do we know in terms of what's going to happen this weekend and in the days to come?
Well, I think the House Intelligence Committee actually laid out some pretty clear parameters for what might be included in articles of impeachment. As Ed said, we're looking at possible abuse of oath of office, almost certainly obstruction of Congress, because the president has stonewalled Congress in refusing to allow witnesses like Mick Mulvaney and other top officials to testify. And also, as Ed said, bribery. And we did see that debate. I think one of the things that the Judiciary panel will be looking at will be how expansive to be. How much should they include, for instance, the Mueller report in their drafting of articles of impeachment? And we're going to see a lot of variety of opinion on this. Some Democrats, those I think in the more moderate camp, would prefer that the articles be constructed narrowly to focus on Ukraine. Others say that they can't ignore the Mueller report because Special Counsel Mueller, as you remember, laid out a path for Congress to investigate whether the president had obstructed justice by trying to thwart his investigation. So We will see that debate over the weekend. On Monday, there will be a Judiciary Committee hearing in which lawyers for the Intelligence Committee will present their reports, summing up the evidence that the Intelligence Committee gathered during its fact-finding inquiry. Then we will see the committee, the Judiciary Committee, move on to drafting articles of impeachment. And they are expecting that we will have a vote on the House floor before the Christmas recess on whether to impeach the president.
Jeff, the president obviously has been very vocal throughout this whole process. I mean, yes. He tweeted during the Intelligence Committee hearing with Marie Yovanovitch, which she responded to in real time. Yesterday, in response to this announcement about articles of impeachment, he tweeted, and this is a two-tweet thread, quote, "The do-nothing radical left Democrats have just announced that they are going to seek to impeach me over nothing. They already gave up on the ridiculous Mueller stuff in quotes. So now they hang their hats on two totally appropriate, in parentheses perfect, phone calls with the Ukrainian president. This will mean that the beyond important and seldom used act of impeachment will be used routinely to attack future presidents. That is not what our founders had in mind. The good thing is that the Republicans have never been more united. We will win." Unquote. Those are two tweets that the president sent yesterday after Nancy Pelosi's announcement. I hear him in terms of saying that the founders did not intend for us to use impeachment routinely to attack presidents. That is true. But broader than that, what do we make of the president's response?
Well, a couple things. I mean, he hits on a couple pieces there of his strategy, the White House's strategy, and the Republican strategy. Certainly the fact that he's underscoring that Republicans are united is key. And that's one thing that's giving him and the White House a lot of confidence, is they know that once this process, if the articles of impeachment are completed and moved to the Senate for a trial, once he's in the Senate, he's got a friendly audience, and at least on the Republican side, which controls the body. So that is helpful to him. He's also underscoring an argument that Republicans have made, which is that his actions are not impeachable, and raising questions about whether the Democrats are doing this for partisan reasons and casting sort of a shadow over that with that question. But he is not quite as far as some of his Republicans are saying that he did something wrong, but it's not impeachable. He continues to say what he did was perfect.
That was kind of the argument that was made somewhat by Professor Jonathan Turley of the George Washington University School of Law. He was one of four professors who gave us that constitutional law lesson this week, three called by the Democrats. Turley was called by the Republicans. They spoke on Wednesday to the House Judiciary Committee in their first hearing about the evidence that had been brought forth by the Intelligence Committee. Here is part of what President Turley, what Professor Turley said about that so-called perfect phone call that President Trump had with the president of Ukraine.
"It's not wrong because President Trump is right. His call was anything but perfect. It's not wrong because the House has no legitimate reason to investigate the Ukrainian controversy. It's not wrong because we're in an election year. There is no good time for an impeachment. No. It's wrong because this is not how you impeach an American president. This case is not a case of the unknowable. It's a case of the peripheral. We have a record of conflicts, defenses that have not been fully considered, unsubpoenaed witness with material evidence. To impeach a president on this record would expose every future president to the same type of inchoate impeachment."
That was George Washington University Law Professor Jonathan Turley testifying on Wednesday. Ed, I understand Professor Turley's argument that you need a stronger stack of evidence to make the American people feel comfortable about impeaching and removing a president, even though there's poll data that says, by some counts, that half of Americans are ready to impeach and remove. So I totally get that. On the other hand, the administration has been stonewalling the investigation, so they can't build the pile of evidence that they want. So I don't know if Wednesday moved the needle at all. I totally take his argument, but in the scheme of things, I don't know whether Wednesday made a difference.
It literally was an academic exercise, and I think it was designed to just sort of spin the wheels while they were putting the finishing touches on these plans to come up with articles of impeachment. So you now have, in the formal record, sort of academic and legal arguments about whether or not you can proceed on this, but so what? You're right. It did nothing to move the needle.
And then frankly, why have the hearing, though?
Because I think they needed to demonstrate that some sense of forward momentum, and that's all it was, is that, okay, we have started, we'll do this, we'll have what many had hoped would be a more sober and serious conversation about the outlines and the history of impeachment, but broke down along pretty predictable lines. And there it was. And if you were someone who was really eager to hear what academics had to say about it, there was your opportunity. But otherwise, I don't think it necessarily, as you said, will persuade folks who are still very evenly divided overall on whether or not this should happen. You can dive into certain states or certain congressional districts to see a little more of a difference in opinion. But overall, across the country, we're still pretty closely divided on this.
And certainly the rancor between Democrats and Republicans was not at all tamped down during the hearing. It was in some ways hotter than it was in the Intelligence Committee. And Cheryl, I'd like to pick up with you on that when we continue our conversation. Also want to get to some of your questions about this whole process. David in Plainfield, Indiana emailed, "One question I have about the impeachment hearings is about who has not shown up. I would love to hear a list of all the people subpoenaed that didn't show up and all the documents that were not handed over." Maybe, Cheryl, you can help us get a scope for what the Democrats want that they haven't quite gotten when we continue with Ed O'Keefe of CBS News, Cheryl Gay Stolberg of The New York Times, and Jeff Mason with Reuters. We'll get back to the roundup in a minute, but first we are reaching the end of the 2010s, which means looking back on a bunch of best of lists from the decade. Well, this week, Spotify released its top five most streamed songs and artists of the decade. The number one most streamed artist was Drake. This song is One Dance by Drake, Kyla, and WizKid, which is the second most streamed song of the decade. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you are streaming, or listening over the radio, to 1A from WAMU and NPR. I don't want to spend time fighting. We got no time, and that's why I need a one dance. Got a Hennessy in my hand. One more time before I go. Higher powers taking a hold on me. I need a one dance. Got a Hennessy in my hand. One more time before I go. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup with Ed O'Keefe of CBS News, Cheryl Gay Stolberg of The New York Times, and Jeff Mason of Reuters. We welcome your questions and thoughts about the week's top stories, so comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. David from Plainfield, Indiana emailed, "One question I have about the impeachment hearings is about who has not shown up. I would love to hear a list of all the people subpoenaed that did not show up, and all the documents that were not handed over." Cheryl, the list is probably
a
little...
The list is long. It's a little too long to read right here, but I can give you a few. Mick Mulvaney, the acting White House chief of staff, was subpoenaed. Charles Kupperman, the former deputy national security advisor, who is asking courts to determine whether or not he has to testify. Energy Secretary Rick Perry was subpoenaed. Two associates of Rudy Giuliani, Lev Parnas and Igor Fruman, both of whom are under indictment right now, were subpoenaed. Those and more than a dozen were subpoenaed and no shows. And we also have some pretty significant people who were not subpoenaed, notably John Bolton, President Trump's former national security advisor, whose lawyer has suggested that he has very relevant and interesting information to share. But the House has not subpoenaed him, thinking that he would just defy the subpoena as the others have. And to Professor Turley's point, there are these lawsuits going on, and if Nancy Pelosi wanted to, she could wait and hold off the proceedings and say, let's let the court resolve these questions to see whether or not we can get this information from these witnesses. She is not doing that. She is simply saying that we're going to move ahead. We consider this obstruction of justice, and our investigation will go on so that if any of these folks do come out and do testify, you know, they'll add to their investigation.
Jeff,
and their facts.
Bolton is a particularly good example there, because he's, in addition to his attorney, he has sort of hinted in various tweets to keep himself in the conversation that he knows something.
He wants to come, I think.
He seems to want to say something. And yet, you know, it's a little bit of a double-edged sword, both for the Democrats and the Republicans. If the Democrats were to decide to wait and let that issue go through the courts, then it delays impeachment, which is not in their political interest. Republicans, on the other hand, can right now say, look, you're speeding this process up for your own political benefit. You're not waiting to hear from people. But if they did wait to hear from Bolton, it doesn't sound like, based on what Bolton is suggesting, they would like what they would hear.
Well, and in terms of speeding up the process, Ed, Dale emailed, why can't the courts expedite rulings on those defying subpoena by committees? This is impeachment, after all. It is urgent to get required testimony.
I mean, why aren't they speeding up somebody else's case? And that's the argument, is that it just takes a while, and these things aren't necessarily designed to be fast-tracked. I think if we get to a point where some of this starts piling up on the front steps of the Supreme Court, they may have to rush some kind of a decision if something is a little more urgent. But
which is not what they like to do.
No, not at all. And that's the other argument that Democrats have been making as to why they're just proceeding now, is they know that if they wait for the courts, this could run until next summer, possibly up until the election, and they don't want to do that.
But worth noting that in 1974, in the Nixon administration, it was only after the Supreme Court ordered the release of the famous 18 minutes worth of tapes that Republicans started abandoning the president in droves. Republicans held tight with Nixon for a very long time. And then once that evidence came out, there was a rush to the exits. And as we know, he resigned rather than face impeachment. So, you know, one could argue that there perhaps would be a similar moment such as that down the road. I don't know. I think it's hard for me to envision
all
Republicans abandoning
the
president,
yeah.
But right, it's hard for me to envision it, but nonetheless, the historical precedent is out there.
And just because they're doing this impeachment doesn't mean either of these committees is going to stop investigating. Intelligence and judiciary have both said they will continue investigating aspects of this even after an impeachment vote later this month. So court cases could become relevant that force the president's hand and potentially force the political will of either party.
So, Jeff, we know that the House Judiciary Committee is meeting basically over the weekend to prep for Monday, where there'll be more hearings. Eventually, they will vote on whether to draft articles of impeachment. More than likely, they will, because the committee is controlled by Democrats. The House will vote on articles of impeachment, which it will probably approve because the House is controlled by Democrats. The Senate still feels like the place where impeachment goes to die. And I'm not sure what's been going on in the Senate in preparation for this, whether the Democrats have a strategy for this, whether they're going to ask for something short of removal, like censure or something else. It just doesn't feel like there's any strategy to go beyond anything but what I think a lot of Democrats would consider a slap on the wrist, a rubber stamp, and saying, you naughty boy, don't you do that again.
I mean, I can certainly say that there's a strategy on the Republican side and on the White House's side, and that is to go in and try to prove that what the president has been saying, that this entire process is a sham, is in fact a sham, and call some witnesses, try to distract by calling Hunter Biden, probably, and Adam Schiff, and putting on a robust case. Whether or not the Democrats, I mean, it doesn't seem to me that the Democrats are willing to go for anything less than asking for removal, even though it's just super, super unlikely that would happen based on the numbers in the Senate.
There's one other aspect of this that we should touch on, and then we're going to move on. We could literally talk about this for the next 3 hours. But one aspect of this, Ed, that I think has come up repeatedly is just the constitutional nature of this in terms of the check and balance that Congress represents on the president. President Trump has said repeatedly that this should never happen to another president. This is outrageous. This is beyond the pale. No president should ever go through that. That is literally incorrect. That is not what the founders intended. And the idea that the president would say, you can't do this to me, is exactly one of the reasons why the Democrats have started leaning on him harder to say, oh, we'll prove to you that we are actually a co-equal branch of government.
Exactly. And thank you for going there, because this grinds my gears when you hear the argument that he makes about due process and you know, that he's not being given his chance. Look, there hasn't ever been a court ruling on whether you actually do get due process rights in an impeachment proceeding. It's never been brought to courts to be settled. He can make that argument, but due process may not even ultimately ever apply in an impeachment proceeding. It is a political proceeding. It is not a legal proceeding. His Republicans and the president are trying to take what goes on Law and Order and apply it to an impeachment proceeding. But that's not the case, because this is a political matter set up by the Constitution. The only roadmap you have is what's in there and whatever legal court interpretations have come from it. And on this specific issue, it's never happened. You can make a fairness argument. That's totally valid. Bill Clinton did it to some effect, because remember, Democrats pretty much held on in the following election. They'll make it over the next year, Republicans will, and they may have a point. But this is not a court of law. This is a political matter. and it will be treated as such by Democrats.
Well, this will definitely set some political precedents going forward, regardless of which way it goes. But there is other news that we want to talk about this week.
What?
So there is. I'm sorry. Don't blame me. They wrote the script. And the next thing in the script has to do with William Barr, the Attorney General. He made some comments this week that got a lot of attention, and several of you have sent us comments about this, so I want to dive into this quick, because this week he said that he is skeptical that the FBI had enough information to begin that probe into whether the president's associates, the now president's associates, conspired with Russia in the 2016 election. The Inspector General of the Department of Justice initially wrote a report that set that investigation in motion. Attorney General Barr cast doubt on that report, and the report is due out next week. Jeff, can you unpack this a little bit in terms of like what the big deal is about this report and how much of this is political versus legal?
Sure. Number one, in terms of the political side, the president and in this case, his attorney general have put a lot of weight and raised a lot of expectations that this report would come out and say the Russia investigation should have never been started in the first place. And that is what apparently the attorney general is casting some doubt on in terms of the conclusions, because the conclusions apparently do not say that. And in many ways, I think that's Attorney General Barr, trying to stay good with the president. And if anything, William Barr has shown that he is on the president's side in many of these things, which has drawn a lot of criticism for him, because opponents anyway, or Democrats and other critics, have said, you know, you're not the president's personal attorney, you're the Attorney General of the United States.
But at the end of the day, Jeff, I mean, what impact would it have? If the IG's report says what we think it's going to say, it's not saying that about William Barr. He wasn't the attorney general at the time. Jeff Sessions was, at least the first attorney general. Like, what impact does it have on him?
Well, it has an impact on him insofar as it's not producing what I think he would like to have produced out of the Department of Justice. And it will not give President Trump the talking point that he was looking for. Now, there may be other things in that report that the president will like, and he has already indicated that he thinks there's been some misquoting and thinks that it's going to be a blockbuster report. So we have to see the rest of the results next week.
There's another comment that the attorney general made this week during a speech about the relationship between law enforcement and the communities they serve. He was speaking at the Attorney General's Award for Distinguished Service in Policing event on Tuesday. And here is the part of his speech that caused so much controversy.
And they have to start showing more than they do the respect and support that law enforcement deserves. And if communities don't give that support and respect, they may find themselves without the police protection they need.
That was Attorney General Barr speaking at an awards event on Tuesday. Now, yesterday, we had Houston's police chief, Art Acevedo, on our program. He's the president of the Major Cities Chiefs Association. Among other things, we asked him to react to the AG's comments, and he referred to Bill Barr's comments, in his words, as hogwash.
Attorney General Barr's statement shows a little naiveness and of not being familiar with the heart of the American police officers. When you call 911, we don't ask whether you're white, black, brown, Jewish, Muslim, Christian, man, woman, straight, gay. We don't ask whether you're a supporter or not supporter. We don't ask where your zip code is. We don't ask if you're a critic, friend, or a foe. We ask, what is the problem? What is the threat? Where are you located? And we roll.
That was Houston Police Chief Art Acevedo, who is the president of the Major Cities Chiefs Association. We have gotten a ton of comments on Facebook about AG Barr's comment. Aaron writes, "That is a terrifying comment coming from the top law enforcement official in the country. What exactly does he mean by respect? Allowing them to do whatever they want without challenge? This sounds uncomfortably like places like China." Contrast that with what James wrote on our Facebook page. James writes, "Currently, municipalities everywhere are struggling to hire police officers because, quite simply, nobody wants to do the job anymore. That is a result of the current societal conditions. But if they don't improve, then fewer and fewer people will want to be police, and thus a massive shortage will occur." That's what Barr is saying. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Cheryl, you covered the protests in Baltimore after Freddie Gray died in police custody. You've covered a number of cases in terms of law enforcement and police brutality. What do you make of the Attorney General's comments?
Well, first of all, it was very clear that he was directing his comments to minority communities, specifically Black communities like Baltimore. And in those comments, I think he completely ignores the important history that his own Justice Department has documented, and that is a history of abusive behavior, brutal behavior on the part of police in minority communities like Baltimore, like Ferguson. I spent a lot of time in those communities talking to people. I can tell you that people in those communities want a police presence. But they want the right kind of police presence. They want foot patrols, not officers in cars running out of their cars to run down drug suspects like Freddie Gray. They want officers who understand the nature of their communities. And I think that it was a very unfortunate comments by Bill Barr, as we heard, offensive not only to minority communities, but also to police chiefs themselves.
Although from a policy perspective, Cheryl, it's not terribly different than what we heard from Jeff Sessions. He was very pro-law enforcement and adamantly tough on crime.
Well, that's true. But if we go back to President Obama and his Justice Department, their Justice Department was very aggressive in going after civil rights violations by police. That unit has pretty much been decimated under the Trump administration. And I would add one other thing. The Attorney General was suggesting in a way that police would, quote unquote, stand down if communities did not respect them. And that is something that we saw happen after Freddie Gray. There was a great controversy over whether or not police were backing down because there had been an uprising in which some officers were attacked and injured. The police chief there said very strongly that police were not standing down. I don't think that that is what the chief law enforcement officer of the United States wants to really encourage in duly sworn police officers.
Ed, there was another story related to crime and law enforcement this week that had to do with federal executions. More than a dozen states asked the Supreme Court to resume federal executions, and that came a day after the Trump administration had asked justices to let the federal government carry out four death sentences. What is this about, and how does this factor into like the current makeup of the Supreme Court?
Well, it's one of those issues that's been sort of percolating through the years as one that could be revisited under more favorable ideological conditions, and so that's clearly what they're trying to do here. And as I recall, executions could resume as soon as Monday, I believe. It could be a federal execution as soon as Monday.
This coming Monday.
Right. So, this is one of those that now with the current makeup of the court, like the gun control issue that was debated by the court earlier this week, like possible abortion ruling cases or abortion rights cases that many believe could potentially, be considered differently now that there is a conservative majority on the court.
Jeff, does this feel like an election year kind of a thing where the administration is talking more law enforcement as an appeal to its base? I hesitate to say that simply because this, as I said to Cheryl, it feels kind of consistent policy-wise with what the administration has always said.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, certainly President Trump has tried to emphasize his law enforcement themes and that those are popular with the base. Attorney General Barr has made a push on the death penalty since coming back. I don't know if that is a rallying cry for Republicans per se or for people who support President Trump. It's certainly a controversial issue in this country, but he's putting emphasis on it and wanting to show some progress.
Cheryl?
I think it is a rallying cry for the president. The president has talked about executing drug dealers.
That's true.
He's said to police officers, don't be so nice when you go into these communities, basically saying rough them up a little bit. He's a law and order guy, and that appeals to the base. It's red meat for the base.
We'll get back to the roundup in just a moment. There was a new report on climate change that directly affects parts of the U.S., including my beloved South Florida. We will have a report from the Florida Keys in just a moment. But first, we remember a legend of sci-fi. Dorothy Catherine Fontana, better known as D.C. Fontana, died this week at age 80. She wrote more than 10 episodes of the original Star Trek series and was a story editor. She contributed to The Next Generation, Babylon 5, and a half dozen other classic shows. After her passing, William Shatner, who played James T. Kirk, tweeted that Fontana was a pioneer and that, quote, her work will continue to influence influence for generations to come. Star Trek pioneer DC Fontana lived to be 80. We'll get back to the roundup in a moment. Stay close. Back now to the Friday News Roundup with Ed O'Keefe of CBS News, Cheryl Gay Stolberg of The New York Times, and Jeff Mason of Reuters. We'll get back to our panel in a minute, but for just a minute, let's get out of the Beltway and head down to the Florida Keys, not just because it's warm there and it's cold here, but because there was a new report that came out about rising sea levels and the amount of money that it would take to keep the region dry. Joining us now to discuss it is WLRN's Nancy Klingener, who covers Key West and has covered it for some time. Nancy, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me, Joshua.
Give us a sense of what this report shows. What's the most dire aspect of it for folks in the Keys?
I guess the dire aspect of it is just what it would cost to keep all of our roads dry with the sea level rise that's projected, and whether that cost is worth it if you're only paving a road that reaches, you know, a couple dozen homes.
Give us a sense, for those who haven't been to the Florida Keys, of exactly what these roads are like. Basically, when you drive down to the Keys, you're taking US 1, and it kind of leads you all the way down the island chain from Key Largo through Isla Mirada to Marathon, all the way down to Key West, right?
That's right. And that road, US 1, is obviously going to be kept viable for as long as possible. But the people live, most people live on the islands off US 1. And there are smaller, lower roads that lead to their homes. A lot of those homes are elevated up on stilts because of flooding. But keeping the roads dry is important because you need to be able to reach your home.
How much work has been done up to now in terms of dealing with sea level rise in the Keys?
Well, they've started building new public buildings like new fire stations up much higher for flood projections. So, you know, we've known for quite a while that this is coming. And nobody who lives in the Florida Keys and sees sunny day flooding is really in denial about climate change. But what was really eye-opening was the cost projection for elevating some of these roads. They did a test case of a road on Sugarloaf Key, and they found that to keep it dry from the king tides, the very high tides we get in the fall, just five years from now could cost $25 million a mile. And for the flooding expected in 2060, that would be $60 million a mile. And that's a lot for, you know, a neighborhood of 30 homes.
And by the way, we should be clear. When you go on either side of US 1, if you're not, like, traveling over water, the neighborhoods on either side, sometimes they're just a few blocks. Like, it could be two, three blocks that juts out from US 1, and then it goes right back to narrowing.
That's right. And they're quite rural in most places.
Now, Florida Governor Rick Scott, now senator, told scientists during his term not to use the terms global warming and climate change in state's documents that got a tremendous amount of pushback. What's the mentality of Florida's government in terms of dealing with this? I imagine if the state is not interested in working with the federal government, then this feels really rather hopeless.
Yeah, we've seen a real turnaround on that with the new governor, Ron DeSantis. He's appointed a chief science officer and a chief resilience officer, and both of them appeared at this climate summit in Key West this week and, you know, definitely are acknowledging that change is coming and that we have to deal with it.
What would we lose if we lost Key West? Talk about what it is that makes that place special to people who live there.
Well, Key West is actually among the higher spots along the Keys. That's why it was one of the first to be settled. You know, I mean, the original settlers were on the higher ground. So, but the Keys as a whole, I mean, it's just a really beautiful and a lot of the time tranquil island community. You have Florida Bay and the Gulf of Mexico on one side, the Atlantic Ocean on the other. So every day we get both gorgeous sunrises and sunsets. We have an amazing environment. We have two national parks, a living coral reef, and really wonderful communities with lots of interesting people doing interesting things.
Before I let you go, Nancy, I remember from every hurricane that I ever covered in South Florida as a South Florida native that the one group of people you could count on not to evacuate were people in the Keys. They're like, no, we've ridden them out before. We're going to ride them out again. And they do. And they make it all all the way through. What about now? Is this beginning to change the way people think about riding it out if climate change is going to dramatically change their home?
Well, I think some of our recent experience with hurricanes like Irma and Wilma back in 2005 have changed that to some extent. But there is definitely a resilient attitude among islanders of survival and figuring out how to make that happen. I mean, people lived here before there was a road, before there was a pipeline bringing fresh water. And I think there's ideas about how to make that happen again, be more resilient.
That's WLRN's Nancy Klingener, who covers the Florida Keys. Nancy, thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
Let's bring it back to the panel with Ed, Cheryl, and Jeff. By the way, did you know that there are direct flights from Washington to Key West?
Oh, yes. Good to know.
Oh, you knew?
No, okay. But now I want to visit.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So you've already kind of planned your post-2020 escape.
Well, it's on the list.
It's exactly. Definitely on the list.
Got to burn those Marriott points somehow.
You know, but first we got to get through the election. But one person who's not going to be making it deeper into the election cycle is Senator Kamala Harris. She launched her campaign
with
a...
That's what we call a good segue.
That's right. That's it. She launched her campaign with a rally in Oakland before more than 20,000 people. And now, less than a year later, she's dropped out of the running this week. Jeff, what do you think were the big factors that forced Kamala Harris out?
Well, the biggest factor apparently it appears to be money. She just wasn't getting enough. She wasn't fundraising enough to stay viable. I mean, she was had already qualified for the next debate in December, the Democratic debate. So it seemed a little bit surprising the timing that she would pull out when there are, you know, other Democratic candidates who have not qualified. But she said in her announcement that she couldn't, in good faith, go forward and telling her supporters that she had a pathway when she didn't see one herself. And that had a lot to do with money. In terms of why she wasn't making that money, I mean, she made some mistakes during her campaign. And one of them certainly had to do with health care. There seemed also to be a little bit of a backfire after that moment that she had with Vice President Biden about race. And apparently perhaps some infighting in the campaign as well.
Cheryl?
Yeah, I was going to say there's a core reason why she wasn't raising that money, and that is that she seemed not to have a clear idea of what her policies were and why she was running, and she kind of did some flip-flops. But more important, as Jeff just raised, there were a lot of internal difficulties within her campaign. There was a lot of tension, a lot of controversy. My colleagues, Jonathan Martin and others, wrote a very explosive story a few days before she withdrew, detailing the resignation of one of her top campaign staffers, who said that, you know, basically the campaign was in disarray, that 90 days before Iowa, they didn't have a clear idea of what they were doing. We had people on the record, a congresswoman on the record, saying that she thought the campaign manager needed to be fired. Kamala Harris had put her sister in charge of the campaign. And so there were just all these internal difficulties. And I think the bottom line is, if you can't run your own campaign, you really can't be president.
Worth noting, though, Ed, with the departure of Kamala Harris, the Democratic pool gets a little more white.
Yes, it does. Cory Booker yesterday or this week in Iowa, actually a few times, pointed out that the party now runs the risk of having more billionaires than black people in the race. Notable comments from Mike Bloomberg on Friday morning to Gayle King on CBS when he was asked about this. And he said, look, diversity, obviously a big concern, but diversity for diversity's sake in this race isn't necessarily worth it if the voters are not accepting those candidates. They got in, they started their campaign, but for whatever reason, they're not resonating with voters. So why change the party rules if they're not resonating, is essentially his argument. Maybe didn't give it as artfully as he could have, but he makes a point, which is this is a marketplace of ideas, and for whatever reason, they haven't been able to sustain themselves. Two things on Harris's ruling regarding timing. It was money, but it was also timing. Friday is the deadline to appear on the ballot in California. And her team decided that amid all these problems, it'd be a little weird to be on the ballot in California and then potentially have to remove your name from the ballot. It would expose her as vulnerable to a potential challenge when she's up for re-election to the Senate in 2022 if she survives. The other is impeachment. If she had to sit in Washington for more than 2 weeks in January for an impeachment trial, any momentum she was hoping to have in Iowa would be lost. And so now impeachment is essentially, victimized at least one member of the Democratic field.
With regards to the front runner, the presumptive front runner, Joe Biden, he had a heated exchange yesterday with a voter who kind of squared off with him in Iowa. The voter was questioning his son, Hunter Biden's, business dealings in Ukraine with that oil company Burisma, and it got pretty tense. Here's a clip.
We all know Trump has been messing around in Ukraine over there, but you, on the other hand, sent your son over there to get a job and work for a gas company that he had no experience with gas or nothing in order to get access for the president. So you're
a damn liar, man. That's not true. And no one has ever said that. No one has done that.
I see it on the TV.
No, I know you do. And by the way, that's why I'm not sedentary. I don't get up and let him go.
So that was part of the exchange between Joe Biden and a voter at a campaign event in Iowa. Jeff, this is one of the first times that Joe Biden has actually like given a full-throated defense of his son. But set that aside for a second. When Joe Biden called that voter a damn liar with his assumption about Hunter Biden, what actually is the story with Hunter Biden? First of all, I think a rich kid getting a job that he's not qualified for, that is not new. That's kind of the American way in some places.
Well, and not really a rich kid.
Well, yeah,
honestly.
Right.
But
like, what is the real deal with Hunter Biden?
Well, a few different things to unpack there. Hunter Biden had a job at a Ukrainian energy company, and it has come under a great deal of scrutiny because, and he has even conceded, really, in one of his interviews that he probably got it because of his last name. So Republicans have focused on that with a lot of attention during this impeachment process. That has put some pressure on Joe Biden's campaign, but there has been no evidence of wrongdoing. One of the reasons Republicans have raised questions about it is because while Vice President Biden was in office, he was sort of the point person on Ukraine. And so they're drawing some connections there that perhaps something shady was going on. No evidence to suggest that. Nothing has been proven about that. And Biden, as we saw in that clip, gets hot about his son. And I don't think it is the first time that he has robustly defended his son. It is, however, a sign that if this keeps coming up, which it undoubtedly will, certainly if he gets the nomination, President Trump is going to bring it up on the debate stage. The vice president's going to have to be ready for it.
Catherine emailed, "I was disappointed to hear that Kamala Harris was dropping out of the Democratic race for president. I found her to be a strong, moderate candidate with good leadership style. I was also heartened by the fact that she is a person of color as well as a woman, and I felt that she would be a valuable candidate." I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. A few more stories we should get to in the time we have left, including, Cheryl, about Congressman Duncan Hunter, Republican from California. He pled guilty to a felony this week. Duncan Hunter was one of the early supporters of Donald Trump in his campaign. But this felony is kind of a big, not exactly a fall from grace, but it's been quite a saga over the last few months.
Yeah, it's a big deal. He was accused and pleaded guilty to one count involving a scheme in which he and his wife, who, by the way, was going to testify against him, diverted $250,000 from their campaign account to their personal use. When Hunter was indicted over the summer, he was stripped of all his committee assignments in the House. And now that he has pleaded guilty to just one count, the House Ethics Committee told him yesterday that he needs to refrain from voting. So frankly, I'm not sure what there is left for Duncan Hunter to do. We know that Kevin McCarthy, the Republican leader, spoke to Hunter yesterday, and McCarthy told reporters that some kind of statement would be forthcoming from Hunter. But as of now, he remains a congressman without the ability to vote and without the ability to serve on committees.
But he hasn't said he's resigning.
So, you know, I don't know how long he can hang on.
Ed, one more story from the administration that affects hundreds of thousands of people on food stamps. This program, SNAP, is the official name of the program. What's the change and why is the administration making it?
Yeah, so Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program. And in essence, what they're trying to do is eliminate the benefits for about 688,000 adults by making it more difficult for states. I'm just reading here because it's easier to do it that way. To waive a requirement that adults without children work at least 20 hours a week or lose their benefits. This has been a longstanding push by mostly Republicans to tighten up the rules in a bid to save money and make the program more efficient. Congress last year in the Farm Bill kept this proposed stricter requirement out of the Farm and Food Bill, but there was language in it that said, if the White House wants to go down this road on its own, go right ahead. And so they're doing that, but they will likely face legal challenges for doing it. Could save several million dollars over the course of it, but again, likely be challenged in court. And arguments have been made this week this is unfair to some of the neediest people in the country.
One last story before we go, because this was a busy week for politics, for sure. Next week will be the same, but it was a really good week for many pop culture fans. A viral video features a song about a character in The Mandalorian, a new Star Wars series on the streaming service Disney+. In its first episode, The Mandalorian, a bounty hunter, makes a moral decision to not turn over the biggest catch of his career, a child that looks like a baby Yoda. Thanks to fans of the show and fans of adorable big-eyed babies in general, Baby Yoda is now inescapable. Fans of the Broadway hit Hamilton will recall the song Dear Theodosia near the end of Act One. Remember that? Dear Theodosia.
Great song.
That song became the viral parody Dear Baby Yoda. And it is equally adorable. We'll play it for you in a second. Now, the character's popularity may have caught Disney by surprise. It has no plans to release Baby Yoda toys until spring. At the earliest.
Uh-oh.
And in the meantime, fans are making their own merch. But Disney is celebrating another Star Wars milestone, the opening of a new attraction called Rise of the Resistance. The early reviews are overwhelmingly positive for what the company calls its most high-tech ride ever. Baby Yoda.
Baby Yoda. I hate to say it, but Rise of the Resistance kind of sounds like Washington, D.C.
But so you've ridden it.
No, but Baby Yoda is so cute.
It is adorable. If you've not seen...
I know. I'm a mom. I just wanted to cuddle Baby Yoda.
I agree with you completely. Cheryl Gay Stolberg of the New York Times, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Joshua.
Jeff Mason of Reuters, thanks, Jeff.
Thank you, Joshua.
And Ed O'Keefe of CBS News. Thanks, Ed.
Great to be with you one last time, Joshua.
1A's lead audio engineer is Jake Cherry, with technical help from Josephine Neonai. Our digital producers are Gabrielle Healy and Chris Castillo. You can learn about our team at the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening and enjoy your weekend. This is 1A.
We'll be around for you. We'll do whatever it takes.
We'll treat out your face.
You'll make us pay $7 for you. Hunters tracking your location. Mando will fight for you. He'll make it right for you. Even though he took the compensation, he'll make it safe for you. You'll be in season 2 and you'll blow.